Good afternoon, everybody. What we're going to do this afternoon for the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to talk about an issue that is practical in estate and trust administration, and that is the income tax consequences of funding bequests. I've got my agenda up here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a little bit of background first on how trust and estates are taxed for income tax purposes, so we're all on the same page as far as that goes. And then what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the three things or the three types of bequests that you're going to run into in administering trust and estates. A specific bequest, a pecuniary marital or pecuniary formula bequest, and a residuary bequest. And all three of them are treated differently for income tax purposes. So this is kind of like a little bit of a practical reminder of when you have a trust or an estate that is going to transfer assets down to a beneficiary, and that beneficiary can be another trust, that there are income tax consequences to doing so. And in transferring that property down from a trust to a beneficiary, you've got six issues that you've got to deal with. The first issue is, does that distribution carry out distributable net income? And I'll explain a little bit later what distributable net income is. If it does carry out DNI, how much DNI does it carry out? Is the trust of the estate, if it's funded with appreciated property, is the trust of the estate required to recognize a capital gain in the funding? And if it's not required to recognize a capital gain, can it elect to recognize a capital gain? What is the cost basis of the asset in the hands of the beneficiary to whom that distribution was made? And what is the holding period of that asset in the hands of the beneficiary? That's what we're going to cover, and I'm going to use an example to do that. So the first thing I want to do is I want to go through a little bit of background on the income taxation of trust and estates, subchapter J of the Internal Revenue Code. As a general rule, what will happen with a trust or an estate is if all the income is accumulated in the trust of the estate, the trust of the estate will be a separate taxable entity, and the trust of the estate will pay the income tax on that income that is earned in the trust of the estate. So if we have accumulated income, nothing is distributed to the beneficiary, everything is taxed at the trust level, and the rate schedule for trust and estates is compressed. Once we have income for this year, 2018, of over taxable income over $12,500, you are in the maximum 37% tax bracket, whereas individuals are much, much higher before they reach the maximum 37% tax bracket. On the other hand, if the trust of the estate does not accumulate the income but makes distributions to the beneficiaries, then what will happen is the trust of the estate will get a deduction, a distribution deduction, for the amount it distributes out to the beneficiary, limited to the trust of the estate's distributable net income, and the beneficiary will pick up that income and report that on their own individual income tax return. So if it's accumulated, the trust pays the tax. If it's distributed to the beneficiary, trust of the estate gets a distribution deduction, limited to its DNI. Beneficiary picks up and reports that income on their own income tax return, again, limited to the distributable net income. So DNI, distributable net income of a trust or an estate, is important for three reasons. The first reason that DNI is important, it is acts as a ceiling on the amount that the trust of the estate can take as a distribution deduction. It also acts as a ceiling on the amount that the beneficiary will have to report on their own individual income tax return. And three, it basically tells you what the character of that income that the beneficiary receives from the trust of the estate. If it's interest, dividends, or rents or royalties at the trust or the estate level, it retains the same character, interest, dividends, rents, or royalty, at the beneficiary level. So DNI is important for three reasons. Acts as a ceiling on the amount that the trust of the estate can take as a distribution deduction. It also acts as a ceiling on the amount that the beneficiary will have to report on their own individual income tax return. For example, if the distributable net income of a trust or an estate is $50,000, and you all are the beneficiaries of the trust of the estate, and I as a trustee distribute $1 million to you, I give you $1 million, and what happens is the trust will get a distribution deduction equal to $50,000, DNI, because the distribution that the trust can take is limited to the trust DNI. The trust DNI, in my example, was 50 grand. That's all they're going to get for distribution deduction. You, on the other hand, when you receive that $1 million, how much do you have to pay in income taxes? You have to pay on the $50,000 of distributable net income. Even though you get $1 million, the amount that you have to account for on your return is limited to the trust $50,000 of distributable net income. So what is DNI? DNI is defined in Section 643 of the Internal Revenue Code as taxable income with adjustments. Now, if you if you've dealt with 1041s and try to calculate DNI, you know that distributable net income is just slightly less complicated than DNA. DNI is basically trust accounting income less deductions, whether those deductions, deductible expenses, whether those expenses are paid from income or for principal. But basically the formula I have up here on the screen, you start with taxable income and you make adjustments. The two big adjustments that you have to be concerned with is that you have to subtract out capital gains from taxable income, meaning that as a general rule, capital gains are not included in DNI, meaning that capital gains as a general rule, subject to the exceptions I'm going to talk about in just a second, are taxed at the trust of the estate level. They don't pass out to the beneficiary. Again, there are exceptions for that. So our distributable net income, capital gains come out, and net tax-exempt income is included in distributable net income. We're not going to go through how to calculate DNI. I just want to show you the formula up here, how this works, just by way of background. As I said, as a general rule, capital gains are included in distributable net income. I mean, are not included in distributable net income. But there are three exceptions. There are three exceptions under the regulations whereby capital gains could be included in DNI and passed out to the beneficiaries. In some cases where you have a charitable deduction, they're included in DNI. And in every year that the trust of the estate terminates, in the year of termination of a trust or an estate, capital gains are included in DNI and they are passed out to the beneficiaries. So with that, that is our basic understanding of how the taxation of trust and estates work. Just by way of review, if we accumulate the income or if we have a distribution, what is going to happen is the distributions are going to be taxed out to the beneficiaries, limited to DNI. If we accumulate the money in the trust acts as a separate taxable entity. And again, if we have a complex trust, same thing, DNI goes out to the beneficiaries. So the thing you have to remember is distributions out to beneficiaries carry out distributable net income and cause the trust or the estate, cause the trust of the estate beneficiary to be taxed on that income. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about the six issues you have to be concerned with when property is distributed from a funding or a parent trust or an estate out to the beneficiaries. The first question you have to ask yourself, does that distribution carry out distributable net income? The second question you have to ask yourself, if it does carry out DNI, how much DNI does it carry out? The next question you have to ask is, if I transfer appreciated property to the beneficiary from the estate of the trust, does the trust of the estate, is the trust of the estate required to recognize a capital gain on that distribution? And the fourth question is, if they're not required, can they elect to recognize capital gain? And then finally, the last two questions you have to ask is, when the beneficiary gets that property in their hands, what is their holding period and what is their cost basis? And we're going to go through each one of those by way of an example. So what I've got is I've got an example that I'm going to use. We have a funding trust or a so-called parent trust, or if you live in California, an administrative trust. And that trust is going to make a distribution of a painting that's worth $100,000. So there is a specific bequest. The next thing that's going to happen is that trust is then going to split into two shares, a marital deduction trust and a family or a residue trust. And what is going to happen is our funding value, the amount of assets that we have in that parent trust, is $2.1 million, $100,000 being the painting, and the other $2 million, what we're going to do is we're going to put $1 million. The formula clauses are going to work out So there's $1 million going into each, the marital trust and into the family trust. Now I realize that that's, you know, those trusts are never equal. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to show you the differences in the tax consequences of the funding of the two trusts. So I'm going to fund those with equal amounts, $1 million. And how are we going to fund that? We're going to fund those trusts with appreciated property. We have stock, 25,000 shares of stock, that has a cost basis of $20 a share and is now worth $40 a share. Now, I fully realize that when somebody dies, they get a bump up in cost basis equal to the fair market value as of date of death. But you don't fund the trust right as of the date of death. You're probably going to wait maybe a year or so, or maybe longer before you fund that trust. So what happened? At date of death, the stock was worth $20 a share, and now maybe a year later, we're funding these trusts, and the stock has appreciated. It has doubled in value to $40 a share, and we've got to determine how that's going to, what income tax consequences that is going to have, what the holding period and what the cost, what the basis of the property is. What we're going to do is we're going to take that painting. And in year 2015, we're going to distribute that painting to the beneficiary. That's our specific bequest. So that's one type of bequest we're going to deal with. Then we're also in the same year, 2015, we are going to fund the marital trust with $1 million. $20 cost basis, $40 fair market value of that stock. In the next year, we're going to fund the family trust, 2016. The funding trust is going to have $150,000 of distributable net income, and I am just assuming that each of those trusts are treated, the family trust and the marital trust, is treated as separate shares, and each of those shares has $75,000 of distributable net income. So we're going to go through this example one by one. Now, what we have is, this is our example right here. We've got our funding trust with $150,000 of D&I. In 2015, we are going to distribute that painting, and we're also going to fund the marital trust with $1 million. And then in 2016, we're going to fund the family trust. At the time we fund the family trust, the D&I of that funding trust will be $75,000. So we're going to go through this example one by one. We have three types of bequests that we're dealing with. Each one of them is treated differently for income tax purposes. So anytime you fund a trust, you're going to have one of these three types of bequests. And like I said, each one is treated differently. That's why we're going through this separately. We're going to do the painting first, the specific bequest of the painting first. Then we're going to look at the pecuniary marital, and then we're going to look at the funding of the family trust. So with the specific bequest first, we are going to fund that painting. We're going to give that painting out to the beneficiary. So the question becomes, is that a taxable distribution to the beneficiary? This is something that I find a lot of attorneys and CPAs miss. If you have something, that a transfer of property from a trust or an estate to a beneficiary, if the amount is a meets the definition of a specific bequest, it does not cause D&I, it does not allow the trust of the estate a distribution deduction, and it does not cause D&I to be carried out to the beneficiary. It is a freebie to the beneficiary. In other words, when we distribute that $100,000 painting to the beneficiary, the trust of the estate will not get a distribution deduction. It falls outside the rules of subchapter J, income taxation of trusts and estates, and the beneficiary does not have to pick up and report that money on their own individual income tax return. There are, so up here, what we've got, is D&I carried out? No. Under Section 663A1 of the Internal Revenue Code, funding a specific bequest is tax-free. It does not carry out D&I. There is no distribution deduction to the trust of the estate. There is no D&I that's carried out to the beneficiary. The beneficiary does not have to report that as taxable income. As a result, there is a carryover basis. That $100,000 painting in the hands of the trust becomes $100,000 cost basis in the hands of the beneficiary. And in addition, because the cost basis from the trust of the estate carries over to the beneficiary under Section 1223(2), which we'll talk about in just a bit, because you have to look at the trust to determine what the cost basis in the hands of the beneficiary is, then the holding period also carries over. So the holding period tax. So if that's long-term capital gain property, which it would be, because when somebody dies, there's an automatic long-term capital gain the property is automatically long-term capital gain property. The property in the hands of the beneficiary will be long-term capital gain property. Now, what are the requirements to have a specific bequest? To have a specific bequest, you've got to have specific amount of money or specific property. The painting, for example, $10,000. I give you $10,000. That's a specific bequest. It's got to be paid all at once or not more than three installments. It can't be paid from income, and there's a fourth requirement that's very important that I don't have up on the screen. In order to meet the definition of a specific bequest, as of the date of death, you got to be able to identify exactly what the beneficiary is going to get. If you can't identify, as of the date of death, what the beneficiary is going to get, then that does not meet the definition of a specific bequest. So, example of how this works, real-life example. A few years ago, my wife's aunt, who lives in, or lived in Wisconsin, died. And she left my two boys and my wife each $10,000. So my youngest guy, who's now 25, when he got his first job, he worked as a barback at this place that had, it was like a concert hall. And eventually, later in that summer, he became a bartender. And he got his first paycheck, and he came home, and he said, "Dad, I earned this much money, but when I got my paycheck, I only got this much money." He said, "What happened to the rest of it?" I said, "Well, they withheld that money in taxes." And he said, "Well, that's not fair. I worked hard for that money. I should get all the money." And I basically said, "Well, welcome to the real world." And he, you know, he went to school, went to college, became a finance major. So he's always been interested in money. When Aunt Marjorie died and he got that $10,000 check in the mail, what do you think the first question he asked was? You think it was, "Do I have to pay tax on it?" No. He said, "Who's Aunt Marjorie?" He had no clue. He had no clue who she was. The only reason that she knew he existed, because my wife sent her a Christmas card every single year with a kid's picture on it. The second question he did ask, though, "Am I taxed on that $10,000? And I said, "No, you're not taxed on that $10,000. That is a specific bequest, because at the time Marjorie died, you knew exactly what you're going to get. You're going to get 10 grand. So that is how specific bequests are treated. That is our first type of bequest. We've gone through that. That's all you need to know. Don't make the mistake, if there is a specific bequest of property under a will or a trust, of issuing a K-1 to a beneficiary, because it does not carry out D&I. It does not give the trust of the estate a distribution deduction. Okay, now, we'll flip over and we'll talk about funding the two trusts. For 2015, we are going to have $150,000 of distributable net income. Separate share rule applies, so I assume in the facts that each trust has earned enough, has earned $75,000. Each of the marital and the credit shelter or the family trust would be allocable with $75,000 of distributable net income. The marital deduction trust is a pecuniary formula bequest to the marital trust. The bequest to the family trust is a residuary bequest. Those are the other two types we're going to talk about. And as we're going to see, the tax treatment is different. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to fund that marital trust with 25,000 shares of stock worth $40 a share with a cost basis of $20 a share. When we go through this, you know, you may think some of the, we'll get to that. So here's what's going to happen. We're going to look at how that's going to be taxed for income tax purposes. I mentioned the fact that the trust gets funded with $1 million. I also mentioned the fact that the amount of D&I that is deemed to be allocable to the marital trust under the separate share rule is $75,000. We distributed $1 million to the marital trust, but because there was only $75,000 of DNI that was allocable to the marital trust, the amount of DNI that gets carried out is 75 grand. Now, you just listened to me talk about specific bequests, and you said, it should be obvious that that is a specific bequest and doesn't carry out DNI. Well, some things aren't as obvious as you might seem. For example, I teach 3 courses at Boston University Law School, and one of the things that I hate to do is to write exams and read the exams. 1 year I was sitting at home and I was writing the exam. I had 3 questions. I wanted to have each count for 33 points because I don't have to go back and do the math if I have one that's 34 points and the other 2 are 33. So I needed a question. I needed one question that was worth 1 point. And so I was struggling with that. And I said to my son, I said, I need one question for this exam that's worth 1 point, my younger guy. And he said to me, Dad, put this on the exam. Ask them who their favorite teacher in the graduate tax program is. So I did. I put that in the exam. Seemed to me like it was an obvious answer. Everybody would get 1 point, but I was surprised. 2 students got that answer wrong. Now, the marital trust, you would think, would be a specific bequest because we figured out by formula that $1 million is going there. But remember, I told you that in order to have a specific bequest, you've got to know, as of the date of the death, how much is going to go in that marital trust. And we don't know, as of the date of death, how much is going to go in that marital trust. Why? Because values could change between date of death and date of funding. We could have elections on the return, on the federal estate tax return, that might change the pot of assets that's available. For example, maybe we elect to take administration expenses on the 1041, the fiduciary income tax return, as opposed to the estate tax return. Maybe we elect alternate values. So as of date of death, we don't know exactly how much is going to go into that marital trust. So as a result, that's going to result in a funding that carries out $75,000 of distributable net income from the funding trust to the marital trust. Now, when we fund a pecuniary bequest, we've got to fund it with $1 million. We're funding that with appreciated property. Anytime we fund a pecuniary bequest with appreciated property, we must recognize capital gain. So what's going to happen is we have to recognize $500,000 of capital gain when we transfer those 25,000 shares from the funding trust down to the marital trust. And when we do that, we transfer that $500,000 down to the funding trust. What is going to happen? Where is that going to get taxed? That is going to get taxed back up to the funding trust. And who is going to bear the burden of that tax? Since we have funded completely the marital trust and the funding trust has to pay that tax, what's going to happen, unless we make an allocation otherwise, is the family trust is going to bear the burden of the tax on that capital gain of $500,000. In addition, the other thing that we've got to worry about is what is our cost basis of that asset, the stock that's now in the hands of the marital trust. Since we recognize the capital gain, we distributed out $1 million. It had a $500,000 cost basis. We recognize the capital gain. We are going to get a bump up in basis to the fair market value as of date of distribution. So the basis to the marital trust of those 25,000 shares will be $1 million. And since we recognize the gain at the funding trust level, we don't get a carryover of the holding period. The holding period does not tack, and I'll tell you why in just a second. It's section 1223(2) that we have to deal with that tells us we won't get that carryover basis. We will get a new holding period when we fund that trust. So now you've seen the situation, the differences between funding a specific bequest and funding a pecuniary marital deduction trust. What happens is if instead of having a gain when we funded with depreciated property. If we funded with depreciated property, we have got related taxpayers Under Section 267 of the Internal Revenue Code, if one person sells to a related person, you cannot recognize that capital gain. Now, when I was younger, I thought I was wicked smart, and I bought Apple stock. You're looking at probably the only person in the United States who has sold Apple stock at a loss. I bought it when they first went public. I held it for a while. Microsoft was competing with Apple for the operating system. Microsoft won. Apple stock took a dive. I liked the stock. I wanted to hold on to it. I didn't want to sell it. My dad says, I'll buy it from you. My dad's a related party. I sold the stock to my dad. I took the loss on my income tax return, which is totally illegal, but the statute of limitations has run, so I'm not afraid of that now. And later on, I bought it back from my dad. Totally wrong, because I'm selling to a related party. If I fund appreciated stock, depreciated stock, to fund a pecuniary marital deduction formula, I'm funding from related party to related party, because one of the definitions of related party, you can see them right up there, I got them right there, related parties, one trust and another trust. So the funding trust and the marital trust are related parties. As a result, I cannot deduct that loss. What happens to the loss? I hold the loss. I don't lose the loss. Later on, if the marital trust sold that stock at a gain, they would be able to use the loss that I hadn't used when I funded the trust to offset part of that gain. What you're going to find is there's going to be two holding periods in that situation. If you fund a marital trust with depreciated property, fund a pecuniary bequest with depreciated property, you're going to find that there is a loss that can't be recognized. You've got to carry that over. It can be used to offset gains in the future. You will have two cost bases for that security. One, if it's sold at a gain, if the securities in the marital trust are sold at a gain. One, a different cost basis if the securities in the marital trust are sold at a loss. So you've got to keep that in mind. Now, up until this week, you probably wouldn't have had this problem. But if you waited until this week to fund your pecuniary marital with what the stock market has done, you probably will have losses when you fund those trusts, and this could be relevant. The only exception to that rule is if you have an estate rather than a trust that is funding that pecuniary marital with depreciated property. If an estate is funding the marital with depreciated property, if it is a pecuniary marital, the estate can recognize the gain, but a trust cannot. There's a big exception there, and it's noted right down to the bottom of bottom bullet point on that screen. How might you get that trust to be able to recognize that loss right away when you transfer from the trust to the marital trust, the funding trust to the marital trust? Have the funding trust make a Section 645 election to be treated as part of an estate. That way, the trust is deemed to be an estate when they fund the pecuniary marital with depreciated property. The estate, the trust that is now deemed to be an estate, can deduct that loss. So that is the related party rule that we got to be aware of. And as I said, we have a new holding period. How do I determine my holding period on transfers of property? I look at Section 1223(2). And what that statute says is this. Basically, if the funding trust holding period, will tack on to the marital trust holding period, if the marital trust has to look and determine their basis in whole or in part, PART, by reference to the funding trust cost basis. And we didn't do that with the marital trust. We didn't have to look up to the funding trust to see what the funding trust cost basis was. Because we sold the asset, we automatically get a bump up in basis, so that statute doesn't apply, and as a result, I don't get to carry over the holding period. The stock in the hands of the marital trust will have a new holding period. Okay? So now we've dealt with specific bequest, we've dealt with pecuniary marital bequest. We are going to talk about the third bequest, which is different than the other two. And the only reason we're going through this is you've got to be aware of, when you're funding, what the tax consequences of funding these trusts are. And it's not all going to be the same. You've got to pigeonhole and say, have I got a pecuniary bequest? Have I got a specific bequest? Or do I have a residuary bequest? And then apply the rules that I've got in the written outline that you people have. So now what we're going to do is we're going to fund that family trust. And that's a little bit more difficult because when we fund the marital trust, we have got some issues that we've got to deal with, and the answers that we may have may surprise you. Like, I was surprised last summer by a response that I got. I live on the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border right by the beach. And last summer, I was sitting down on the beach reading some stuff, and this little kid and his mom were playing catch with a tennis ball. And the mom would go to her son, "Nice catch, Mikey, and nice throw, Mikey." And then all of a sudden, Mikey missed one of those balls, and it rolled over to where I was sitting. And I picked up the ball, and I said, "Here you go, Mikey." And the kid went all caps on me, and he said, my mom calls me Mikey, but my real name is Michael." And I said to him, "Well, my mom calls me Jerry, but my real name is Jeremiah." And he looked at me kind of funny, and I said, "Jeremiah, that's a prophet. I was named after the prophet Jeremiah." And I said, "Do you know what a prophet is?" And he goes, "Yep, my dad told me. It's when you buy something for $2 and you sell it for $5. Didn't expect that response. And when we go through funding the family trust, you may not expect the response or the answers I'm going to give you. Because when we fund a residuary bequest with property, there is a specific code section that governs that. And that code section is section 643E of the Internal Revenue Code. And we're going to go through, we have got two choices with section 643E, and we're going to go through them right now. 643E basically says this. The general rule is when we fund a residuary bequest, and this will be a fractional marital as well, because a fractional marital bequest is the equivalent of a residuary bequest. When we fund a residuary bequest with appreciated property, the general rule is the amount of D&I that is carried out is equal to the cost basis of the asset. $20 a share in my example. However, and if we do that, we got $20 of D&I that's carried out. And the general rule is when we transfer that stock to fund a residual bequest, no gain or loss is recognized. So that's the general rule. We fund it with appreciated stock. The general rule is the amount of D&I that's carried out is the $20 per share, the cost basis of the stock. No gain or loss is recognized. But you have an option. And the option is you can make an election to have the fair market value of the stock be deemed the amount of D&I that is coming out to the residuary bequest. But if you want to make that election and have the fair market value be deemed the measure of the D&I that comes out, you have to recognize the capital gain. And this is a great planning tool because if you think about it, as I said earlier, when we have a trust that has gains in it, the general rule is gains are taxed at the trust of the estate level. And once the trust of the estate has $12,500 of taxable income, bingo, you're on the 20% long-term capital gain rate, whereas individuals have to earn a lot more money than that to be in that same 20% maximum tax rate. So what we want to do is we'd like to get gains out to the beneficiaries and have them pay the tax on the gains. So generally what we'd want to do in this case is apply the general rule, have the cost basis be deemed to be carried out, have no gain recognized, then the beneficiaries have the stock in their hands with a $20 cost basis. They can time when they want to recognize that gain. Alternatively, if the trust of the estate had losses at their level, we can make an election to recognize the gain at the trust of the estate level, use that gain to offset the losses, and basically wash the gain by using the losses, applying the losses against the gain. So we've got a lot of real wiggle room here, and a 643E election is very valuable if you're trying to get gains out to a beneficiary. So how does this work? Here's how this works. Let's assume we don't make the Section 643E election. We apply the general rule. What will happen is the measure of D&I that is carried out to the beneficiaries will be $500,000, the basis of the stock. Now, I've got up there only $75,000 of D&I is carried out. Even though the measure of the D&I carried out is $500,000, remember, We only have $75,000 of DNI in my example, and the beneficiary is not going to have to pick up and report any more than the amount of DNI that is earned in the funding trust, that $75,000. Even though the measure of the DNI being carried out is $500,000, the cost basis of that stock. So therefore, we get $75,000 of DNI being carried out. We apply the general rule. 643E says if the cost basis is the amount that's deemed to be carried out, we don't have to recognize any gain or loss. Our basis is going to be $500,000 because Section 643E, when I back up, it says the basis of the property, that's the third bullet point, third big bullet point down, the basis of the property of the beneficiaries is the basis of the property in the hands of the funding trust, plus or minus any gain that's recognized. Well, the basis of the property of the funding trust was $500,000. We didn't recognize any gain, so therefore the basis to the family trust is going to be the $500,000. And since we had to look to the funding trust to determine what the basis of the property in the family trust would be, it is determined in part or in whole by reference to the funding trust cost basis, we get to carry over the holding period. 1223.2 tells us that we can carry over the holding period. So that 643E election, assuming the 643E election is not made. Let's assume we make the 643E election. Watch the differences here. What's going to happen is this. The amount of DNI that's going to be deemed to be carried out, the measure of the DNI will be $1 million, the fair market value, because when we make the 643E election to recognize capital gain at the trust of the estate level, the amount of DNI that's the measure of the DNI carried out is $1 million. But remember, we only have $75,000 of DNI, so only $75,000 of DNI is going to be taxable to the family trust. Notice if we did not make the 643E election, the measure of the DNI carried out is the basis, $500,000. If we do make the 643E election, the measure of the DNI is $1 million. Even though it's $75,000 in each example up there, the measure of the DNI is different depending upon whether or not we make the 643E election. Since we are making the election in this situation, we have to recognize that $500,000 gain. When we recognize that $500,000 gain, Section 643E, backing up again, says our cost basis is equal to the basis of the property in the family in the funding trust, $500,000, plus any gain that is recognized. We recognize the $500,000, so therefore, our cost, or the family trust cost basis in that asset, because we had to recognize gain, is $1 million. What is our holding period? We had to look at the funding trust to determine how to calculate the basis in the hands of the family trust. We looked and we determined that basis in whole or in part by reference to the basis of the funding trust. We took the $500,000 basis of the asset in the funding trust, and we added the $500,000 gain. 1223.2 tells us that because we had to look and determine the cost basis in whole or in part by reference to the cost basis at the funding trust level, that therefore the family trust gets a carryover basis. So you can see that what we've got here is we've got a gain. Now, where's that gain going to be taxed? That $500,000 gain is going to be taxed to the family trust. Why is that? Because now, in 2016, we have distributed everything out of the funding trust out to the beneficiary A. We funded the marital trust in the preceding year. Now we're distributing everything out to the family trust. We are terminating the funding trust. In the year of termination of the funding trust, all capital gains get added to DNI and get passed out to the beneficiary. So as a result, what will happen is the family trust, if we make the 643E election, will get a tax letter saying that you have to report $75,000 of DNI plus another $500,000 of DNI, because that gain is going to be added to the distributable net income. So the family trust would have to report $575,000 of taxable income. So I am just about done. I just want to remind everybody where we have been. What we talked about is the fact that when you make transfers of property to fund trust from a one trust to a beneficiary, and that beneficiary could be an individual, it could be another trust as well. When we do that, there are income tax consequences. We reviewed the basics of subchapter J and the income taxation of trusts and estates. And what you have to do is you have to pigeonhole these distributions and identify it either as a specific bequest. There are certain rules that apply to that. Or a pecuniary marital. There are certain, or pecuniary bequests, certain other rules that apply to that. Or a residuary bequest, 643E applies to that, and you have two options. So what you've got to ask yourself is, does the distribution carry out D&I? If so, how much? Is gain required to be recognized when you fund with appreciated property? We talked about what happens if you fund with depreciated property. And if you do have to recognize gain, how much? What is the cost basis of the asset in the hands of the distributee beneficiary, and what is their holding period? So I have outlined this ad nauseum in the written outline, so if a lot of this stuff doesn't make sense, take a look at the outline. I have footnotes provided. With that, I am done. Thank you for your attention.